This week on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
And it's because of our economic system that we've been able to prosper as a society. And compared to any other system that's out there, it's lifted more people out of poverty. It's increased and expanded life expectancy rates. It's decreased mortality rates. And it is a tried and true system.
Attention passengers, we ask that you please fasten your seatbelts at this time and secure all baggage underneath your seat or in the overhead compartments. Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is prepared for takeoff.
Beautiful sunny day here in Flyover Country on Wednesday, March 20th. I am Joe Arnold, usually a roundtable host, but today I am the griller of the one-on-one talking to the titular Scott Jennings of Flyover Country.
I'm sorry, the what?
The titular.
Yeah, that's what I am.
Your name's in the title. Oh, speaking of which, I need to point this out.
Yeah.
McClatchy, I saw Flyover Country, I think for the first time mentioned in national press, maybe second time.
Yeah, we've been in the press a couple of times, but our friend, not friend of the pod because he hasn't been on, but my friend, Dave Catanese of McClatchy, wrote an article this week about Mitch McConnell and his sort of the aftermath of his decision not to run for leader, what that might look like for him in the future. And this podcast was mentioned in some comments that I made about McConnell being using his role on the Appropriations Committee, particularly to focus on defense appropriations. And yeah, I made an oblique movie reference to the movie Old School. I said, we're going to have a Mitchapalooza. And I said, he's being re-released into the wild. So I keep asking people, do you get these movie references? Only Dave Catanese got it. Everybody else.
He enjoyed it.
He did, obviously, and reprinted the whole thing. So we, in Kentucky.
I've seen Old School, Will Ferrell.
Yeah, if you are in Kentucky, you can read Dave Catanese's piece and all his pieces in the Lexington Herald Leader. That is the McClatchy outlet in Kentucky.
You know, my hometown back in Belleville, Illinois, theirs is a McClatchy paper as well, Belleville News Democrat.
Interestingly, if you're interested in the news business stuff, you sent me a clip today about both McClatchy and Gannett, which owns the Louisville Courier-Journal, the other big paper here, dropping the Associated Press.
So Gannett, which is the parent company for the Courier-Journal, I think is dropping the AP altogether. McClatchy, I think, is scaling back dramatically. And first of all, the Associated Press, in terms of its history in this country and the way that of news gathering, to be able to pool resources and to be able to cover things, in places other than your own home market, it's the backbone of many of these news outlets. I you would have to think the reason why they're reducing this is so they can save money. At first blush, the Gannett's saying, well, we can reinvest more in our own reporters.
Right.
Not that many local newsrooms have been necessarily doing that.
Yeah. It's interesting. At a national level, the Associated Press, I don't know if you followed this discourse, but online on X, with some of their posts and headlines and the framing of some of the stories in the national news, have really come under fire from conservatives who have just really, really come to dislike the way the Associated Press has, just framed the national conversation, whatever going on. I don't have any examples at hand, but it's pretty frequent now where you see, AP tweets something or writes something and conservatives are immediately jumping on that. So the way we thought about it, I think when you and I were back in the journalism business, back in the radio business, is different maybe than the way people think about it now, and obviously different than the way some of these newspapers think about it.
I have been concerned since even while I was still part of the Fourth Estate, in terms of the overall direction of how we fund and how we staff newsrooms.
Yeah,
because beyond outsourcing much of the national reporting, I mean, frankly, we're fortunate, I think, in Kentucky. By the way, I should point out Bruce Schreiner, who was the main Associated Press a political reporter, I think it has a stellar reputation. He's someone who I would fight with in terms of like for scoops and things, over the years. But I think we're fortunate to have a solid reporter for the AP locally. I'll just say that. But I will also tell you that it's amazing how much power that, and we're fortunate that someone who's fairly, who's solid in that respect, we're fortunate that we have that here because the AP wields incredible power.
Oh, yeah.
Because as soon as that narrative is cast, it's going to be repeated in newspapers then and in other outlets who subscribe to it across the state or across the country.
And it also forms the basis of a lot of television news reporting.
Right.
It comes off the wire.
It's all framed that way. And so it's remarkable for Gannett to be saying they're going to be scaling back. But what I was going to say is that, you know, what newsrooms have done while they still have AP right now, both the Courier Journal and the Herald Leader and others have invited third-party funders to come in and subsidize certain reporters' salaries with the understanding they're going to cover certain beats in a certain way. And if you look there's all kinds of outlets across the state now that these are funded by oftentimes out of state,
like nonprofit type things,
right. and they're regarded as nonpartisan,
but they're not.
Well,
sometimes.
Well, they could certainly be nonpartisan in the sense that it's not sponsored by the Republican Party or the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But they certainly are. They have an activist bent.
Absolutely.
And as a result, so there's things called Report for America. There's ProPublica.
Yeah.
And things like this. But there's a certain expectation you're going to cover the news in a certain way. So the reason I bring this up in you bringing up the AP is that suddenly you have, regardless of what more recent complaints have been about the Associated Press, you have a situation where we already have been sort of outsourcing news coverage to other organizations who are funding these embeds in local news. And always consider the source, but I don't know how many people are going to take the time to kind of really think about
how would you ever know?
Who's writing the check for the person who's writing the story? It's just an interesting, you know, conflagration.
I do want to second your comment about Bruce Schreiner, longtime reporter here. Actually, you know, I think over time, my long history here in Kentucky media and politics, the AP's always had, I think, very solid people. Bruce is probably at the tail end of his career, and I say that lovingly because he's had such a long and legendary career here, but really just, I think, churns out the news in a solid way. Also, beats. You brought up beats. I am such a fan of beats. And when you said that, I thought, I'm gonna have some beats. You said it, and it sounded good to me.
I was like, what? Where is he? I thought you were talking about the audio headphones at first. You're talking about the literal
beats.
The root vegetables.
I was having dinner once with some people and an important person, and they hadn't yet gotten to the table, and one of their people said, and I was looking at the menu, I said, oh, a beet salad. And the guy goes, oh, he doesn't really like beets. You shouldn't order the beets. And I was like, well, he's not going to be eating it. I'm going to eat it. I ordered the beets. That's how much I like beets. I did it in the thought that I may actually offend the person I was eating with. I went ahead and ordered it anyway.
Was this the president you were with? Who are you with?
I don't want to say. I don't want to cause beet futures to decline.
I mean, George H.W. Bush didn't like broccoli.
I don't want to
famously.
Say, I'm just saying there are powerful people who don't like beets. I like beets, and I'm willing to stand up for them so much that I was willing to put them on the table with someone who is not a beet fan. So anyway, I'm glad you brought it up.
It's so ridiculous.
This morning. I called you early this morning.
Yes.
Because it was so nice to have a baseball game on, a live.
Did you wake up at 5 o'clock on Eastern time to watch any of this game?
I get up at 6 with the kids, and so I immediately turned it on, and I had it on my phone, had ESPN on, and just was so glad to have a baseball game on. As I took the kids to the bus and was getting ready and going around taking the dogs out. Just amazing. Major League Baseball is back. We don't have the full opening day experience until next week, but the first game in Korea took place, and the Dodgers beat the Padres, and I just loved having it on in the background.
It was interesting, the whole the fan experience there at the stadium in Seoul. First of all, that you have like cheerleaders who don't stop throughout every at-bat, and apparently they come up with different cheers for every player.
I think there's a song for every player, and the song, it's like they lead the
like
crowd.
Like a chant?
Like a, yeah, it's like, well, they call them songs. I mean, it's like a little, Yeah, like a little jingle or something for each player, and they lead the crowd. But as you said, the Koreans are very polite, and they sit in their seats, and they're very enthusiastic. And it made me think, why don't we pass a law in this country to force people to sit the F down at sporting events? I go to baseball games. I went to the SEC tournament. I saw Kentucky lose
basketball
last Friday. Took one of my kids. And, you know, these chuckleheads sitting in front of me stood up 95% of the time. First of all, Kentucky was losing the entire game. You know, sit down. They're losing. Secondly, you know, what's the guy behind you supposed to do? So then we're standing up. Then what's the people behind me supposed to do? Then they're standing up. And it's just a ripple effect of stupidity. And so I appreciated what they were doing in Korea. You know, hockey fans get this right. They wait to go down the aisle until there's a stoppage of play. But, you know, you and I have been at baseball games before, and it's like, you know, bases loaded, 3-2 pitch. You know, and here comes, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle, you know, ambling down the aisle carrying 8 bags of nachos that I can't see what just happened in the most pivotal play of the game.
I just want to say that, first of all, it's really fascinating to be on the other side, the receiving end of the old man shakes fist at the sky conversation. This is usually me.
I feel like Joe Biden right now, staring at a bowl full of Snickers. You bastards, you're smaller than you used to be. And I'm not going to take it.
I will tell you that my father-in-law I'll have to forward this podcast to him, because this is, he's a UofL football season ticket holder, and I often go to the games with him. And I hate to say he's passive-aggressive, but usually it's just like, down in front. But I will tell you that there are some younger folks, especially, and in the soccer world, they're like, get over it. We're going to stand the entire game. That's just the way it is. I'm with you. And what's this, by when you and I go to baseball games now, our new strategy the last couple of years.
Yeah. Sit in the front row of a section.
Even if we're in the fourth level up.
We'll sit in the front.
We'll sit in the front row.
Yeah.
And I don't mind sitting, because that way there's no interruption. And I guess you're hitting right on it.
I just, you know, even at spring training this year when we were down there, you know, people are just going up and down the aisle. Look, I know the games don't count and everything, but I came there to watch the game. I didn't come there to look at your huge ass right in my face. Sit down. Get out of my face. All the time. Hockey, they get it. They get it right.
How old are you now?
87 years
exactly.
Old.
Well, welcome.
And I went to the stadium uphill both ways.
That's right.
In the snow.
Well, I want to welcome you to the old man shaking their fist at the sky club.
I'm glad to be here. I feel like I should run for an officer position with this rant.
Well, since you brought up age and office holders, back to McClatchy for a moment here. The one comment that was in there, and I found it very interesting as far as news coverage again.
Yeah.
That there was, apparently there's this news coverage or understanding or sort of like this assumption that when Mitch McConnell announced that he was no longer going to be the Republican leader of the U.S. Senate after this current cycle, that he would all, that somehow people are presuming or conflating that with his own electoral plans in Kentucky. And there was nothing in that announcement at any point where that he said anything about whether he's going to run for re-election or not.
Yeah, he only announced that he wouldn't be running for Republican leader, but his term goes through 2026. He would face re-election in 26, which would be the midterm for the next president. And he has made no announcements about that, and in fact has been aggressively raising money for his re-election committee, both outside and inside the state of Kentucky. So I would just tell everyone who's paying attention, McConnell's made no announcements about his reelection plans, and it would be folly to assume anything at this point.
Speaking of Leader McConnell on the floor of the U.S. Senate, just a little while ago here, as we're recording this on Wednesday, March 20th, at about noon hour here, but he was talking about the tragedy continuing in Israel and as far as this the attacks by Hamas on the Israeli people, and now the Unity War Cabinet in Israel trying to wage in war against the terrorists who caused that bloodshed, and really kind of once again continuing calling out Democrats and in particular, you know, Chuck Schumer for undermining, you know, the government of Israel.
Yeah, this whole issue has really ratcheted up the last couple of weeks. Obviously, there are still hostages, which is terrible. And I guess there's this ongoing dialogue in the background between the Biden White House and the Netanyahu government about whether the Israelis are going to invade and do a ground invasion in Rafah to get some more of these terrorists and root them out. And the Biden White House is trying to stop them from doing that. I mean, they're trying to tie the hands of the Israeli government. At the same time that's happening, Schumer goes to the floor last week and effectively calls for regime change in a democratic ally of the United States. They had free and fair elections in Israel. They're our ally, and we're over here dictating. Well, this caused an amazing backlash, not just from Netanyahu, but his political opponents and people who don't really like him effectively told Chuck Schumer, butt out.
We're a sovereign nation.
We're a sovereign nation.
McConnell on Wednesday morning, I was worried to see the U.S. intelligence community opine publicly on the stability of the Israeli government. It seems to me we should ask our intelligence professionals to keep their assessments of our closest partners a bit closer to the chest. Think about how embarrassing our colleagues would find this behavior if it was directed toward any other democratic U.S. ally. Think about how we might be received if the DNI or CIA director publicly commented on political tensions within Germany's coalition government, or on the decision-making processes of President Macron, or on the declining public support for the Trudeau government in Canada.
Right.
So what is the difference between Israel and these other nations that he just mentioned?
Well, great question. I think it's obvious that some of our policymakers view Israel as less of a partner and an ally and more of a client state, you know, that they somehow answer to us, that they're somehow bound to effectively, at the end of the day, do what we say. And that's just not true. You know, they're their own nation, and they suffered a terrible terrorist attack, and they have terrorists on their border. I mean, what would we do, you know, if we had terrorists literally on our border? I mean, it's a sad, terrible situation, and the interference with the Israelis who need to fight this war and end it and win it, both as a military matter and then as a political matter, it's very strange, but it's caused a lot of political rhetoric, consternation, confrontation, really heated up. And I've got a clip here from former President Donald Trump, who went on the Sebastian Gorka radio show, which is on Salem, and he said this, and then we'll play the reaction.
Those Palestinian marches, even I'm amazed at how many people are in those marches. And guys like Schumer see that, and to him it's votes. I think it's votes more than anything else, because he was always pro-Israel. He's very anti-Israel. Now, any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion, they hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves, because Israel will be destroyed. You have Iran now making a nuclear weapon. None of that would have happened with me. That's a big thing. With me, Iran was broke. They were absolutely...
Could you? So that was Donald Trump on Sebastian Gorka's radio show. And what really set everybody off was the chunk there where he said, if you're a Democrat and you vote... If you're a Jewish person and you vote Democrat, you hate your religion, you hate Israel. And...
Yeah, it reminds me of a certain quote that some people kind of dismissed in the last presidential election from the current president.
You have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black. You have a
problem. Isn't that pretty yeah. much the same thing?
Well, I think Trump. Well, first of all, let's talk about the reaction. This has set off a firestorm on the left. Chuck Schumer has referred to this as anti-Semitism. A lot of people in media have gone crazy about this. So this has really set off a firestorm. And I see your point. I do think what Trump was getting at, and maybe he stated it inartfully, but here's what he was getting at. Well, first of all, the political reality of Jewish votes in this country, they vote three quarters for Democrats. So this is a huge constituency for the Democratic Party. He knows that. Number two, what he is, I think, getting at is that a lot of, I think, Jewish Democrats in this country are having to confront the uncomfortable reality that the political party they're in and that they have been comfortable voting for a long time now contains a lot of very, very anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish people. people. I mean, you know, Trump mentioned the rallies that have been going on in the cities, the people who are running around tearing down the posters. You know, there are a lot of people out there saying a lot of vile things about Israel and the Jewish people. They're cheering on the terrorists in a lot of ways. Those are, in many cases, those people would definitely consider themselves liberal, progressive Democrats. And so if you are a Jewish Democrat and you're seeing all this unfold, I can imagine it's very uncomfortable to think that I'm now in a political party with people who effectively have decided now is the time for my anti-Semitism to become my defining moment for political activism. And I sense that's what Trump was getting at. I don't think he should have said it the way he did.
You can't say that this is a... You can't question someone else's faith.
No.
If it's your belief system, it's your belief system. Now, you can certainly say, I don't understand this. And to me, make a compelling argument rather than just to attacking people's personal faith or their convictions. To me, I would say, listen, I am here to support Israel and to support the right of people in the Israeli state to exist and to practice their faith freely. And this is the one nation in the Middle East where you're allowed to do that, you know, and you have that kind of society. But instead, as opposed to coming out and saying that you are somehow undermining your own belief system. I mean, I can see. I mean, I'm Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
And there are times where people might say, "How can you vote X on either side?" Because there's no particular political party which completely matches up with my theology. See my point?
Yeah.
And there are times as well that my own belief system doesn't match up with my church's theology.
Right.
You know, and does it make me a cafeteria Catholic? Maybe.
Well, this conversation goes on with Joe Biden all the time. I mean, you hear Republicans argue, you know, one day Joe Biden will talk about what a devout Catholic he is, and the next day he's out here, you know, promoting a pro-abortion agenda. And so you hear these kinds of conversations in the intersection of faith and politics. It just struck me over the last few days, this conversation got ratcheted up massively. And I don't know where this leads us. I mean, this war is not going to end anytime soon. I think the thing that is still most shocking to me about all this is just the attempted political interference in Israel by Schumer. You know, Biden sort of put it at arm's length and supposedly, according to the reporting, reassured Bibi he's not trying to interfere. But when you have the leader of your party in the Senate, your close ally, go out and make a speech like that, it's not by accident. I don't think Schumer would have done that if he had thought Biden would have been very upset with him. And so, you know, and I don't know what the political future holds for Israel and how that government's going to continue. But I know this, we should not be dictating to a Democratic ally who is in charge of the government. That's for the people of Israel to decide. And so I think as long as the Biden White House is going to continue to interfere militarily, which they apparently are right now, and you have Schumer who wants to interfere politically, it's going to be rocky relations, I think, between the United States and Israel. And you do wonder how that's going to impact the upcoming election. If you consider, you know, 3/4 of Jewish Americans have been voting Democrat or so, you know, does that come down a few points because they don't want to be in a party with Palestinian protesters and they don't want to be in a party that interferes, you know, with the Israeli government? Maybe. It well could. My gut instinct is that Trump senses this as an opportunity. Now, you know, there's nothing nuanced about Donald Trump, right. And obviously he used the most incendiary rhetoric possible. But I have a feeling we're going to continue to see both sides of this coin be a dominant part of the presidential campaign landscape, at least for the next few months.
Begging your indulgence.
Absolutely.
I want to, just to put a button on this, I do want to go back to the floor and hear from Mitch McConnell.
Absolutely.
And because this is a moment of moral clarity as well as of statecraft, and there's one person left in the United States government, and it's Mitch McConnell, who is clearly stating these aims.
Let's get one thing straight. The violence and this humanitarian crisis rests entirely on the shoulders of Hamas. This entire conflict would end if the cowardly terrorists who rule Gaza from beneath schools and hospitals released their innocent hostages.
Yeah, and in that floor speech that you're listening to there, he went on to chastise Schumer for interfering in Israel's internal political affairs as well. I think McConnell has just, in this whole process, as he often does, has brought such clear-eyed thinking to, you know, it's easy for people to try to conflate things and make this convoluted. Well, it's more complex. No, it's not. Hamas is a terrorist organization. They raped and murdered people. They're holding hostages. And the United States should not stop Israel from getting the terrorists. And we should not politically interfere with Israel at a time when they are waging war against a terrorist organization. Period. Full stop. That McConnell has been so clear-eyed on this. It's been, you know, when you've got so many other, I think, strange things emanating from the Democratic Party, I think he's just been such a vital voice. If you're someone who values our relationship with Israel and you're someone who values the idea that the Jewish people deserve to be outraged and demanding of return action in this war, then Mitch McConnell's been speaking for you.
He says to the people of Gaza, you can turn on Hamas, you can turn on the terrorists. He says to the people of Israel, basically pay no mind to the peanut gallery.
Yeah.
I mean, you stick together, you do your thing, and I'm going to continue to have your back. So kudos to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, you know, something we've not talked about in here, but you know, it sits in the back of my mind, is some of the public polling that's been done in Gaza among the Palestinians. And you know, I think there's often a reach when you hear Democrats talk about these issues to say, well, you know, Hamas is different. They don't speak for the Palestinian people. But, you know, some of this polling has been pretty stark and pretty pretty grim when you see the high levels of public support from the Palestinians for what Hamas did on October the 7th and what they continue to do. It's that from the beginning, the idea that you would have a whole population cheering on, or lots of people, I should say, cheering on terrorist actions. It's ugly. It's really ugly. And of course, these hostages, we don't know how many are left alive because Hamas won't provide a list to Israel of who's alive and who's dead. Ought to tell you something. But they continue to languish. Either the alive ones, which, by the way, some Americans and some children.
Which is just shocking. When you think about the fact that we have American hostages.
Yeah. We don't know their condition, but they're languishing. Mm. And I don't know, man. It's an ugly time. And obviously, we now have the intersection of a presidential campaign. I assume the rhetoric's going to get ugly. And we just, you know, when McConnell sort of focuses us in on what are the core facts, mm-hmm. who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, what needs to happen next, I hope everybody in the Senate's listening.
We heard Trump a moment ago and on the Sebastian Gorka radio program, which I did not know existed, but now I know. Certainly Donald Trump still an outsized factor in the primary contests going on across the country. In Ohio on Tuesday night, Bernie Moreno, the former, I guess he's a car dealer.
Yeah. This is one of the rare Republican primaries one of the rare political campaigns, really, where both Donald Trump and Chuck Schumer were on the same side because the Schumer outfit intervened to try to boost Marino. And, of course, all the Trump people wanted Marino, and that's what they got. So congratulations to Marino. He's now in one of the most targeted Senate races in the country against Democrat Sherrod Brown.
And to be clear, so this is a primary contest against a non-Trumper, if you will, Senator.
Other candidates.
Matt Dolan and yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Dolan was sort of the ascendant he was like the so-called non-MAGA or establishment. And then you had another guy, Frank LaRose, who was kind of flagging there at the end. But Marino got it, and as has been the case in most races, the Trump-backed candidate experienced a surge of support and enthusiasm down the stretch. And Trump campaigned for him, J.D. Vance campaigned for him. So they got what they wanted there, and so did the Democrats. It's interesting. They wanted Marino. Remember last cycle we talked a lot about this, where Democrats were trying to interfere and engineer certain kinds of nominees, and they did it. They helped here. I don't know if they were definitive, but they certainly had a preference. But now I think Ohio, I mean, look, Trump's going to win there, and it's been one of his strongest states. And, you know, Sherrod Brown, I think, is one of the top one or two most endangered Democratic incumbents. You know, I've been very bullish on the Senate map the whole cycle. You now hear Democrats out there whispering, you know, well, the Republicans got the wrong nominee in Ohio, and we've got this abortion referendum on the ballot in Montana. That's the other state now. So you're starting to hear a little pushback on that from the D's. I would still rather be Republicans than Democrats looking at this map. I mean, there's not a single endangered Republican incumbent, and Republicans just have to win one. So we'll see how it plays out, but congrats to Bernie Moreno, Republican nominee for Senate in Ohio.
What's this say about Donald Trump's relative strength and relevance, especially, and I ask this question, Scott, because the rival headlines on Donald Trump are that he has this, you know, this bond he has to pay off in the civil trial there in New York, a $454 million bond, and he has to comply with that, I think, within a week. And he might have to start selling off assets, and he says, like, at fire sale prices. And so here, I mean, you're seeing kind of his personal wealth and be challenged, and almost his personal life, I'm not saying unravel, but he's grasping at straws here, trying to find some way to pay this thing off. So here he's weaker and weaker in that regard, but seems to be stronger and stronger politically.
Yeah, the state of New York is obviously trying to cripple him personally. You know, they had the E. Jean Carroll suit and what he had to pay there. Now you've got this suit and the judgment on the – I mean, it's a fraud trial, although they never really decided who had been defrauded. But, you know, and the amount of money, $460-something million, is astronomical.
Yeah.
And his lawyers say they can't pay get a bond to pay this, which I guess he can appeal, but he can't stop them from beginning to seize his assets is the way I understand it. And I know we're still in the middle of this, so we'll see how it plays out. But I think you're right. I think in order to make this payment, he would have to sell something off. You wonder, by the way, and I know nothing about how any of this works, but they said they called 30 bond companies or insurance companies to try to do this, and you just wonder, like, at the highest levels of those companies, what those conversations were like, because obviously he has the assets to back something like this, but my imagination is a lot of them just said we just don't want to be involved.
Well, the trial in and of itself, though, we're saying that he was inflating the value of his assets on paper so as to be able to secure better financing arrangements, interest rates, etc., with whoever was loaning him the money. So
but none of the banks were suing him.
That's exactly right.
And none of the banks were mad, and all the banks said they got paid back. So, you know, it was who got hurt here? I don't know. I've heard other real estate people say this is pretty ridiculous when you consider what else goes on in the business. I don't know. This is not my business.
Right.
But I will say I do think they are, meaning New York, these legal people, they are trying to cripple him financially, personally.
And at a certain point, I mean, regardless of what you think about Donald Trump, he is a human being, and you only have so much energy, time.
Bandwidth.
Thank you. At a certain point, I think that it would have to take a toll.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure it's deeply frustrating to know you've been drug into court in New York. And by the way, they're not done with him. He's got this criminal trial coming up where he's this, you know, I always call it on TV, the sex paperwork case.
Right.
But that still has yet to come. And he could be convicted of an actual crime there. These other matters were civil matters. So the state of New York is all the Democrat prosecutors up there doing their best to cripple Donald Trump and take up as much of his bandwidth as they possibly can. So we're still in the middle of this few days here as we record this, where I guess it's not quite clear how they're going to settle this appealing this judgment.
And I think he has till Monday to actually post this bond.
So I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm glad I don't have to come up with $460 million. I know that.
I mean, it's something else. But as far as his do you think this Moreno victory is just another affirmation that he is the what is it? I guess the standard bearer is the way to put it, right?
He's the most popular figure in the Republican Party, and when he wants something to happen in the Republican Party, it most of the time happens. Not always. Mm-hmm. He doesn't always get his way on policy matters. Case in point, the other day, the TikTok bill that came up in the U.S. House that would force the ByteDance that owns TikTok, which is affiliated with the communist Chinese government, to divest and to sell it. He came out against that, which was a 180 over his previous position, but he came out against it and was pretty public about it and had all his allies in the House come out against it, and it still overwhelmingly passed. He doesn't always get his way, but when it comes to purely political matters, primaries, and so the imagination of the Republican Party, he almost always gets his way. You do have a few people here and there that buck it, like Congressman Thomas Massie of Kentucky, who survived it once. But most of the time, he's getting his way. And now that he's the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, I mean, without question, he is the leader of the Republican Party. And as a political matter, for the rest of this year, what he says is going to go, for the most part, with probably rare deviation.
So you mentioned Congressman Massie of Kentucky, but also Congressman Morgan McGarvey, the lone Democrat member of the Kentucky delegation, siding with Donald Trump on this TikTok situation?
Yeah, you had two guys who don't like Donald Trump, Thomas Massie and Morgan McGarvey, teaming up to vote against the TikTok bill. And the other four congressmen in Kentucky voted for it.
And the bill, again, would force ByteDance to divest of this and have maybe a domestic or a U.S. Owner, or at least a non-Chinese Communist Party owner.
Yes. And, you know, ByteDance's reaction to all this tells me all I need to know about it. You know, I mean, having their users, their teenage users, call up members of Congress and threaten to commit suicide or to murder these people, and really was quite a thing. But apparently they're doing it again in the Senate, and having all these outraged calls pour into the switchboard and people making outrageous comments. I don't know when it's going to come up in the Senate exactly, but it feels like there's momentum for this, although I've heard, you know, indirectly from some of the TikTok crowd that they think they can kill it in the Senate. It'd be kind of fascinating to see here. It doesn't ban TikTok. It simply means they have to divest or shut down. So they could easily sell it. I even read former Trump Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was on TV the other day saying he's putting together an investor group to try to buy it,
right?
Which I'm sure he won't be the only one if this bill ultimately passes. Would you vote for it?
Vote for I would support forcing ByteDance for that company to separate itself.
So yes,
from the
– yes, vote for it.
I would.
Yeah. I think I would too. I think it's a minimal move, honestly.
It's not a free speech situation.
No, it can operate.
This has to do with not only an adversarial foreign government having a direct pipeline into and an unaccountable one into the hearts and minds and just the information sharing in our country. It just, frankly, I think that we're going to see more and more of this challenged on a state level as well in terms of foreign ownership of farmland.
Oh, I think
especially Chinese.
I think that the Chinese government has gotten very aggressive with its incursions into our economy, real and information. And I do think we need to stand up to it, because the more you don't, the more they do. And you don't know what form it's going to take next. And so I hope this passes. I think it's a good thing. I mean, candidly, I think you could make a case to ban it outright. And there's no question. Is there a bigger distributor of anti-Semitic information in the world right now than TikTok? I mean, in terms of raw users' ability to get messages out, is there a bigger distributor? I don't know. I mean, but it seems like, based on what I've read, a lot of anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic material goes out to a lot of audiences on TikTok right now. And that's one of the most recent things. There have been other sort of things that have been fed into the pipeline they don't even allow this version of TikTok to operate in China.
Right.
They don't allow it. And China doesn't allow U.S. social media companies to operate in China. Doesn't that tell you something?
I mean, I'm somewhat of a First Amendment hawk. However, and you and I have had many conversations over the years on social media in and of itself in terms of how much regulation is consistent with our American freedoms. I am probably coming around more to what I think was your point of view at the time, which is to understand the toxicity of social media, in particular for our children. And I don't know how you enforce, in the same way as you enforce not selling tobacco products to children, not selling alcohol to children. To me, there has to be some sort of limitations or guardrails put in place. And up to this point, I think we have said we have to trust parents to be the arbiters of that. But there's no, it's just the reality of life in the 21st century is that, and because of the nefarious way that this, that the digital media can reach anyone, including a, you know, a 7-year-old, it's impossible to monitor that. And so to me, there has to be something put in place legislatively, regulatory, that, that would somehow be able to support and become a backbone for that process.
I do think the American U.S.-based social media companies are trying, and I think they're putting, in my opinion, I think they are doing things that are on the helpful end of this, and I think they recognize some of the responsibility they have, and they're working towards it. I believe that. When I look at all of them as a group, which one do I trust the least? The ones that answer to the communist Chinese government. I mean, obviously.
Right.
The ones that I trust the most are the ones that are U.S.-based and obviously sensitive to our government and sensitive to our consumers here. So I'm not opposed to what the Congress is doing here, and we'll see how it plays out. Maybe we can have some be interesting to have some people on to debate this that are more steeped in the technology policy. Because I agree with you. This is not going to be the last time we wrestle with questions like this.
That's Scott Jennings. I'm Joe Arnold. Coming up next on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings, you have a special guest.
Yeah, I'm going to interview and have interviewed, for your listening pleasure, a man named Harold Kim, who is with the United States Chamber of Commerce. Harold has a new and interesting project he's working on there regarding free enterprise, which I think is important. Harold and I go way back. You know, he and I worked in the Bush White House together a long time ago. He was in legislative affairs, and I was in the political office. And so Harold and I have known each other a long time. He's had a great career at the U.S. Chamber, and he wanted to come on and talk about his new activities there. So we're going to do it next here on Flyover Country with
Scott Jennings.
Hey there, Flyover Country listeners. Today's episode is brought to you by the Bluegrass Media Lab, Kentucky's premier media studio. The Bluegrass Media Lab offers a wide array of services, including video production, podcasting, live shot broadcasting, web development, media training, and more. You name it, they do it. Head over to bluegrassmedialab.com today to get in touch. Now, back to more Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
And welcome back to Flyover Country. This is Scott Jennings. Thanks to my buddy, Joe Arnold, as always, for coming in for our roundtable discussion in the first half of the show. For the second half, as Joe mentioned, we have a great guest on Flyover Country today. My old friend, not too old, but an old friend nonetheless, Harold Kim from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Harold, good to see you on the screen, my man.
Yeah, it's great to see you too, Scott. Good to see that you're doing well.
Hope yeah, Kentucky doing great. Well doing great well. Here in Kentucky. Yeah, and I always enjoy it when we get to talk because it reminds me of how far back we go working for George W. Bush together all those years. You were in the legislative affairs shop and I was in the political affairs shop. I think the first time we ever met, you were accompanying me to Capitol Hill where I had been subpoenaed by the dastardly Democrats who ran one of the committees. So our relationship was forged in a strange time, but has endured all these years.
Oh man, the good old days, right? It seems like
the before times, as I call it, the before times. But you've been at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce now for how long?
It's been over 15 years, which seems like it was yesterday when I left the East Wing of the White House. I literally walked across Lafayette Park with my box in hand. And basically came to the chamber and said, I'm here.
Yeah. You've carved out a really interesting career with the chamber. And over the years, you and I have had lots of discussions about the issues you've been working on. Legal reforms, you know, for instance, is something I know you've been very interested in. But the reason we're chatting today is because you are taking on a new role with the U.S. chamber. Well, actually, you know what? Let's start here.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people hear about organizations in Washington and, you know, pro-business and what they might be doing. Can you just kind of give us an overview? What does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce do on a daily basis? What's the principal mission of the organization at large? And then we'll specifically get into your new venture.
Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been around for over 112 years, and we are the largest business organization and network that includes relationships with state and local chambers across the country. In fact, it was the state and local chambers that in the early 20th century came together at the request of President Taft and built the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as the convening voice on behalf of the entire American business community. So we've gone through two world wars, through a Great Depression, through ups and downs throughout our economy, and we're still standing today. And we advocate on behalf of the business community, whether in the hallways of Congress and state legislatures, and something that we continue to do on this very day.
I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the chamber's role in advocating for and against certain pieces of legislation. Yep. I think sometimes what happens a little more behind the scenes is its role in holding to account the regulatory regime of the executive branch of the federal government. And I just want to personally thank you and the chamber. You all have often held Joe Biden's administration to account on a number of regulatory issues that have huge impact to the day-to-day operations of all kinds of businesses.
Enormous impact. You know, we've got federal agencies and agency heads that are going well outside of their guardrails. You know, they're doing things without the authority of Congress. They're regulating in areas that they have no expertise. And it's being driven on a scale that we've really never even seen before. And so the amount of uncertainty that the current administration's regulatory agenda has is very, very significant. And so our litigation center has brought a lot of legal challenges to test the boundaries of these authorities. And we've been incredibly successful in our federal courts, and something that continues, unfortunately, at a very you know, pernicious clip in terms of the amount of regulatory litigation, and something that is critically important for small businesses, mid-sized businesses, and large companies.
I mean, really, the core issue is free enterprise and capitalism. Yep. And just the ability of people to form companies and to ply their trade and to operate in a marketplace where you don't have a government that is constantly undermining that marketplace, constantly undermining the system that really made this country great. What is your opinion about the state of free enterprise in America right now? And what are some of the looming sort of threats to our, you know, the way we do it as the United States? What would you say are the biggest threats facing the concept of a free market and capitalism and free enterprise?
Yeah, Scott, I think our free enterprise system has been our operating system for our democracy for centuries now. And it's because of our economic system that we've been able to prosper as a society. And compared to any other system that's out there, it's lifted more people out of poverty. It's increased and expanded life expectancy rates. It's decreased mortality rates. And it is a tried and true system that now, unfortunately, is under assault on a much more systemic level. We're seeing hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by foundations and other organizations that are discrediting our free enterprise system. And we see it playing out in our everyday work, whether it's the federal agencies, state and local governments enacting regulations and legislation that is fundamentally anathema to free markets and open markets. We're seeing a retreat on international trade, which has stimulated so much growth and opportunities on a global scale. And these are all being attacked in a very orchestrated and coordinated way, where there is a significant amount of resources behind this to fuel this. We see it with academic institutions, whether colleges or with law schools and higher learning institutions, in addition to think tanks. And it's all coming to try and change our belief system when it comes to the benefits of our current economic model. And it's the chamber that has to really stand up and to be vocal and loud about the benefits of the system in order to protect it from these collateral attacks.
Yeah, it's not as clean as it used to be in Washington. You know, for most of my political career, it's been thought of that the Republican Party was the party of business and the Democratic Party was the party of you know, the labor, you know, to generalize it. But the lines have gotten muddled. And as you pointed out, just even on international trade, you know, there are a lot of elements in the Republican Party now that have become very hostile to the idea of international trade. And there are even some elements in the party that have become hostile to just corporate entities altogether. It's just not as clean politically
in Washington as it used to be. How do you all navigate that? I mean, I think it's become incredibly complex to try to navigate the political system now when it's just not altogether clear who are your true allies and who are your, you know, who are your true enemies when it comes to protecting this free enterprise system.
Well, Scott, you're 100% correct that the attacks are coming from both ends of the political spectrum. It's either the progressive left or the populist right. And, you know, for us, it's really standing up to principle in terms of a model that has worked for, again, centuries. And it's a proven model. So we have to really defend with articulating the arguments, the data, the information that substantiates what policymakers, what thought leaders need to know in terms of the benefits of our free enterprise system.
I know this is a topic that's very personal and passionate to you, and I've really enjoyed over the years hearing you talk about your own personal story and about your family. Tell us the Harold Kim story. How did you come to be today in Washington, D.C., and really start from the beginning? Because I think our listeners would find it to be very fascinating.
Well, you know, as I reflect back on my 53 years, and I can't believe I just said that, but I'm dating myself. My parents were immigrants.
You'll be old enough to run for president in 30 years. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I think I'll take a hard pass on that. I'm a first generation Korean American, and my parents came here to the United States after the Korean War. And they came here at a time when, you know, they fled a country and communist aggression where there was very little hope for opportunity. And they eventually became small business owners. I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places. And they opened a motel and a pizza place. And my mom would make the pizzas. My dad would clean the rooms. And, you know, I saw the value of hard work and what it meant for them to give them the opportunities to their only son. And for me to be working at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce here in Washington, to have worked for President of the United States with you, you know, are things that I think is an enormous proof point when it comes to the opportunities that this country brings because of the system of democracy, because of the freedom of expression and the ability, you know, to have agency and to, you know, to basically build a life where it was completely foreign to them, where they had language barriers and even racial tensions. But this was the country of opportunity. And for me personally, to have the ability to defend the very system that has brought me to where I am sitting today is not just a job, but it's everything that epitomizes who I am as a person.
Yeah, I think the word opportunity is a huge word. And when you think about the system that you're defending and what you're doing at the U.S. Chamber, reminding people that, you know, we have a unique thing here in the United States. And when you compare that to other countries, Venezuela, North Korea, China, just how special it has been for human beings, for quality of life, for human rights, you know, for the perpetuation of the kinds of values that are fundamental to what it means to be an American. That's ultimately what you're fighting for. And I do appreciate that you spend a lot of your time trying to remind people, look, you know, this only continues if we fight for it to continue, because that's right. There are a lot of people in this world who'd love to do away with it.
That's right. You know, I often look online on Google satellite maps, and at nighttime, if you compare the Korean Peninsula between North and South, it is such a stark contrast. You have light versus darkness, hope versus despair. And it really is a picture that speaks 1,000 words. And that the north side of the peninsula is what my parents fled, because they knew that they would not have the opportunities that the United States has brought to them, you know, as immigrants, but as also somebody who wanted to start a family and a new life here.
So in your new job at the chamber, focusing on protecting the free enterprise system, I am assuming that you have access to lots of people, lots of material, lots of things. For our listeners, what are some of the who are passionate about these topics? What are some of the books or podcasts or resources or other things that you sort of pay attention to on a daily basis that you find to be vital to, you know, kind of fueling the information that you use to do your job?
Well, for your listeners, I would suggest that they go visit our website and look at our State of American Business page, where our president and CEO, Suzanne Clark, really mapped out the threats, as well as the vision in order to protect our free enterprise system. There are some other sources that I think offer some really important food for thought. There's a book titled The Capitalist Manifesto that was recently written by Johan Norberg. He's a Swede, he's an academic, but he has an incredibly detailed book about the benefits of the free enterprise capitalist system. And it's got a rich amount of data that he studied. And I think it's something that's an incredibly important piece of information that's going to animate this debate moving forward. And the last thing that I'd recommend your listeners to go to is Google Yunmi Park. She is an escapee from North Korea, and she found her way here to the United States. And she speaks firsthand about what it was like living in communist North Korea. And she is a thought leader in this particular space. She's got clips on YouTube. She's probably out there in the social media world as well. So I would, just as a quick curtain raiser, just hit those three sources, because it should give you a substantial amount of information of what we're talking about.
Obviously, you're doing a lot of deep thinking about this right now. And I guess I wonder, why now? You know, what was there something that triggered this now for you? And as a secondary question, do you think that our education system in this country right now, whether we're talking about primary education or post-secondary, do you think we're doing a good enough job in instilling in our students of all ages why this system is great, why it works, and what they can do to be part of it? I get the feeling that we're not, and I also get the feeling that they're currently being bombarded with, frankly, by malign actors with bad information about sort of the fundamental core of the American system. So why now? And any comment about whether the next generation coming is prepared to take up the same mantle that you are at the chamber?
Well, why now? I think that we are at an inflection point in terms of a critical mass of concern as to what is happening with these attacks against our free enterprise system, and that we need to do something immediately because there's so much that is at stake. You know, we see advancing technologies. We have global instability. Things are happening so quickly that if we don't act with agility now, it'll be too late. So there is a keen sense of urgency that we are advancing here at the U.S. Chamber that we think has to be addressed immediately. You know, in terms of the education issues, look, I have kids who are in high school and one in college, one going to college in the fall. And I think the answer is we can all do a lot better. You know, one area that the chamber has focused on is to increase the understanding of the younger generations when it comes to just how civics works here. How does government work? How can you be a participant, whether it's through jury service, through voting? And that is something that the chamber has really taken on as an important imperative. So yes, it is critically important to address kids and their development from an educational perspective, because they are our future. They're gonna hold an enormous amount of political power and spending power. And in order to have them understand and appreciate the message of free enterprise is gonna be a critical focus for us moving forward.
I worry a lot about this. I think the way information is being distributed throughout this world on a number of topics, whether it's, you know, what we're discussing today, or, you know, whether it's what's going on in the Middle East, or, you know, you name it. I think there's so many bad actors in this world who would love nothing more than to destabilize the United States, that this critical piece of it here, you know, this idea, you know, why is America great? You know, why have we been able to achieve everything we've achieved? I think there are so many people out there who would love to just destroy faith in it. You know, they would. And the best way to do that is to destroy it when people are young, and to try to make them believe that somehow this is all rotten at its core. And so I appreciate very much that you're taking this fight up, because I think we're in a war against a lot of people who'd love to see the United States fail. And it's a war of information, and it's a war of values, really.
And ideas. I mean, America represents the greatest form of self-governance that womankind has ever seen. And it is a system worth defending on so many different levels. And to be part of it is truly something that I am incredibly motivated to do as part of my career here at the Chamber.
So if people want to get involved in this, if people want to get in touch with you, what should they do? Because I suspect you're going to find a lot of folks out there who think, yeah, the free enterprise system has helped me make my life and I want to protect it. What should they do?
They should go to our website at uschamber.com. Again, it's uschamber.com, and you can sign up and you can stand up for free enterprise.
That's great. Harold Kim, thanks for coming on. By the way, are you taking this on the road at all? Are you going to do any traveling, making some appearances out there, I assume?
I think I'll be racking up the frequent flyer miles and my Marriott rewards moving forward, because I think the message has to be spread.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I hope you find great success out there and a lot of receptive ears to what you're doing, because I think this is I mean, we're obviously having a presidential election this year, and but more than that, I feel like the United States and what we do and the way we do it has never been more under threat from bad actors all over the place. So thank you, Harold Kim, for doing your part, and thanks for coming on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings today.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
That's Harold Kim of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You can find him at uschamber.com and sign up for updates about what the U.S. Chamber and Harold are doing to defend free enterprise. And thanks for listening to the show today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Flyover Country with Scott Jennings. Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is a production of Bluegrass Media Lab, coming to you from the heart of Middle America, Louisville, Kentucky. If you like what you heard, subscribe to Flyover Country on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcast.